Hi, I'm Heather Mulder.
And I'm Janice Greeno, and you're listening to Dementia Untangled, where we explore the topic of dementia through conversations with physicians, experts, and community leaders.
Our discussions focus on innovative ideas, practical strategies, and proven methods to guide caregivers along a supportive path.
Hello, and welcome to Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of our podcast.
Today, our conversation will be with Dr. Jeremy Prusin, who is a neurologist at Banner Alzheimer's Institute. And we're going to be discussing depression, apathy, and dementia. Janice, we're talking about a very heavy and also very complicated topic that a lot of families experience caring for someone with dementia. I mean, this is something that we have to look from the caregiver perspective, the stress and the burden that they are experiencing in this role, but also the prevalence of this happening in the person with the disease too. Coupled with this, the pandemic that we have been living in for an extended period of time, this can be overwhelming and frankly, it's unheard of before. So we're really hoping our podcast untangles the differences between depression and apathy and in dementia, and that we can reduce the stigma that goes along with this that caregivers and people living with the disease are experiencing.
Absolutely. It's so true, Heather. So many people don't want to talk about depression. They don't want to talk about apathy. But in our support groups, I'm really glad people share about what they're going through. And I've had caregivers ask me, what do I do? My loved one doesn't want to do anything anymore. Or sometimes it's more personal from the caregiver. And we do know that the burdens of caregiving can be so heavy. And I've heard many people share that this is so hard. Maybe it's the grief or the loneliness or the frustrations and fatigue or all of the above, from all the struggles that they're going through, that they're just so difficult. And when I hear this, I always encourage people to reach out for help. And I'm so glad that we are talking to Dr. Prusin today, because I understand that with the right support, depression is quite treatable with effective interventions.
Welcome, Dr. Prusin. Thank you so much for joining our conversation today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So we always like to start these conversations in a similar fashion and want to learn a little bit more about you. Can you tell us about your journey and what led you to connect with the dementia community?
Sure. So starting way back when I was a teenager and in college, I was always interested in thinking and the brain, and first sort of got into psychology and then a little bit more the harder neuroscience of it when I was in college. And at the same time, for part-time work, I took care of, you know, kids with disabilities, mostly low-functioning kids with autism who needed a lot of help. And I really enjoyed that work, really in the trenches, you know, helping on a daily basis, being a caregiver, and even being a private nanny for one particular person that I got to know very well and working with his family. So going forward in life, I wanted to marry the two, caring for people who may be more vulnerable and also continuing my pursuit of learning about the brain and memory and thinking, and eventually found and started volunteering at Banner Alzheimer's Institute and was really interested in the field, contributing both scientifically and helping families with this terrible problem. And, you know, went to med school, did neurology residency with the intention of entering the field, and did a fellowship in the same sort of dementia, behavioral neurology, and doing some research, and found my way back to Arizona, where my family is from, to start working at Banner Alzheimer's Institute and to try and continue to contribute more.
Well, welcome back, Dr. Prusin.
Thank you.
So let's kind of start with the basics. Can you describe some of the signs of depression? How might we recognize this in someone?
Sure. So there's some cardinal features of depression, and they can sometimes manifest differently depending on age group and a person's situation. So often signs of depression will manifest differently in elderly. One thing that is common is sleep disturbances. So either really excessive sleep or more commonly not being able to get to sleep or stay asleep, some really significant problems with insomnia. And that can be a big sign that somebody may be depressed. A sort of lack of interest or leaving behind activities people once enjoyed, sort of not getting pleasure out of things they would normally get pleasure out of, you know, being with family or whatever it is previously that somebody enjoyed that they no longer enjoy, that can be a sign as well. A feeling of guilt, feeling like you're not worthy, so to speak. In the elderly, it's more of a feeling of, tends to be a feeling of worthlessness, like they're, you know, past their prime, so to speak, and nobody would notice if they were gone. Tends to be the more common manifestation in people that are older, as opposed to a feeling of guilt. And then a lack of energy, so just not having the motivation or energy to get out and do things, which is a bit of an overlap there between apathy, which I'll talk about shortly. Problems with concentration or thinking. So that's sort of, it used to be called pseudo-dementia if somebody was really depressed and elderly. Sometimes their cognitive symptoms were really just from a pretty significant depression. And sometimes, you know, you can sort of have both, but certainly somebody who has no dementia, a young person, frequently will complain about problems with concentrating, thinking, even memory problems when they're depressed. Changes in appetite, more commonly not eating, but also sometimes people will overeat. And then changes in a person's actual physical mannerisms. So they'll become maybe slower. They look like they're sort of sulking. It's this sort of Eeyore type of feeling that you may notice in somebody. We call that, you know, psychomotor slowing. And then often in dementia or people that are elderly, it may be the opposite, where somebody becomes highly agitated. They're pacing around, they're picking at skin, they just can't stop moving. And it's really a result of their inner mental state and can be a sign of depression as well. And then, you know, thoughts of death, dying, suicide, of course, those would be really a big red flags that somebody's significantly depressed. And those are sort of the cardinal features and how depression is really diagnosed and defined as a clinical entity.
Dr. Prusin, thank you so much for sharing all of that with us and going into it just a little bit deeper than maybe a list we might read online. And I noticed that when you were sharing the list of various things, you often mentioned the words a change in. And I wondered, even when you say a change in maybe someone who had been very interested, involved in things before, but now doesn't want to do things anymore. So there's this lack of interest. It kind of seems like that might be apathy. And I just wondered, you said there can be some overlap. Can you tell us what is the difference between apathy and depression in dementia?
There can be a significant and is often a significant amount of overlap between the two and can sometimes really be hard to differentiate, or maybe there's a little bit of both going on. Apathy, the best way to think about apathy is really just a lack of motivation. And that's usually sort of the cardinal feature. The one most important thing that you'll notice is that a person just doesn't really want to do anything anymore. It could be similar to this lack of interest, and you know, they're really one and the same. A key difference, though, typically when somebody's depressed is they'll be more bothered by it. They say, oh, I don't do this anymore. I just don't feel like doing it. And they kind of wish they did. They'll have the other symptoms that we talked about, or at least some of them that come along with depression. Whereas the apathetic person, they're really content with the change in their life. They are just fine sitting on the couch all day, you know, watching Family Feud for the rest of their life or whatever it may be. And so they really don't seem bothered otherwise. They're just kind of hanging out, being there without a motivation to do the things they used to do and are quite fine with it. Again, that's in contrast to depression, where there's other symptoms and the person's going to appear more bothered by their lack of energy or the fact that they've left behind activities. So I think that's a good way to differentiate it. And as such, what follows from that is that very frequently, when a person has more of a peer apathy and they've lost motivation, they don't do things that they want to do anymore, it's often the spouse or a caregiver, family who are bothered more by this problem, who notice it more, as opposed to the patient or person that is, you know, being treated themselves. I'm fine. I'm older. I'm retired. I don't want to do this. You know, it doesn't bother me. This is what I'm doing with my time. Whereas the caregiver or spouse is disturbed because of they've noticed this change in their person. And so it's more frequent when somebody has a more pure apathy for the caregiver to bring up the issue and want it to be addressed as opposed to the patient themselves.
Oh, that's so interesting.
I agree, Dr. Prusin. Thank you. I think it's such a subtle difference, but yet an obvious one when it's spelled out, how the depressed person almost has this underlying discontent that comes with it, this urge that they should be doing something and they're bothered by it, whereas apathy, they're perfectly fine. However, the family is the one who's disturbed by it. Can you talk to us a little bit more about the science behind this? Where are these symptoms coming from?
Apathy, and really in severe forms, we find that, and I think a lot of what we've learned is when there's significant damage to the frontal lobes, to the sort of motivation and what we call executive function centers in the brain. And, you know, you may think about Alzheimer's disease as a more temporal lobe, memory center, other parts of the brain, but it certainly can affect those centers, as the motivation centers and the frontal lobes themselves. So a couple of good examples to think about that people may or may not be familiar with, but I'm happy to explain. So frontal temporal dementia is, as its name implies, more of a dementia of the frontal lobes and sometimes the anterior or temporal lobes. And what you see in that form of dementia is just an extreme apathy where people will really just not want to do anything and be absolutely not bothered by it at all. I have one patient who used to play golf 5-6 days a week religiously. That was really their life. And their spouse became really concerned when they basically just stopped playing golf and didn't really care about it. Eventually diagnosed with frontal temporal dementia. But when the frontal lobes are out, it really causes a person to just not have the motivation to do anything. And another really extreme example is in stroke. So there's a stroke syndrome where the artery in the front of the brain it tends to be connected, even though, you know, we sort of have two arteries for the most part, one on each side of everything. There's a syndrome where a stroke can block off both of the arteries to the front part of the brain, the anterior cerebral artery, and essentially take out the frontal lobes. And those people can literally be so unmotivated that they won't speak, that they won't respond. We sort of call that akinetic mutism. It has a name, not important, but it's a really unfortunate situation because you think the person's not even there, they're not paying attention, maybe they're not listening, they can't hear. You're even concerned that maybe there's something else wrong with them after they're in the hospital with a stroke. So you sort of have to give them a little bit of a jolt or a pinch, and then they'll sort of respond to make sure that they're doing okay. It's really, they just don't care even enough to respond to you in the room. And that's what happens after a significant stroke to both sides of the frontal lobe. So those are two very, very extreme examples, but they can sort of illustrate this concept of a person who's there, who can think, who has maybe their memory's not as affected and otherwise, but they just don't want to do anything and they don't care about it. So I think those help delineate and sort of define what severe apathy can be. And you can, specific injuries to the part, to the front part of the brain.
You know, it's fascinating to me to hear you talk about the science. And on our podcast, we really like to untangle the science. And one of the things that we were talking about before the podcast was, you know, what came first? People ask it often, what came first, the chicken or the egg? But what came first, the depression or the apathy or the dementia? And does one cause the other or vice versa?
This is an all of the above type of answer. And you have to look at each individual situation. Certainly, we know it goes both ways that, you know, being depressed for long periods of time and having it untreated is a risk for a future dementia. But also some people who have never been depressed and all of a sudden become apathetic or depressed late in life, that can be a first manifestation of a neurodegenerative disease. Certainly we see apathy commonly in Alzheimer's disease for something like Parkinson's disease or Lewy body dementia, Parkinson's disease dementia. Often anxiety will come on in somebody who's never really had anxiety before as part of this the syndrome of their neurodegenerative disease. So it really goes both ways in that I think something like Alzheimer's disease can induce or cause a depression, and a depression earlier in life certainly can be a risk factor for future cognitive decline. So that's something in my clinical visits that I always ask about if somebody is having neuropsychiatric symptoms is, you know, do they have a history previously of being depressed in their 20s or 30s or earlier, or have they always been, you know, pretty good in terms of their mental health and mood and all of a sudden developed some psychiatric or mental health issues late in life? Because that can be a sign of worry if that has happened. So the answer is all of the above in short.
I think this has been really helpful in helping us to understand how dementia and apathy manifest themselves. But I understand how just very difficult this is for caregivers to deal with. If you have someone who is unmotivated, whether it concerns them or not, it's very difficult to function day to day. How can caregivers combat depression and apathy? Is it a medication? Is it routine? What strategies have you seen work?
We'll start with apathy. This one is tricky, right? Because you do as a clinician and as a caregiver, you want your person affected by whatever it is, Alzheimer's disease or whatnot, to stay active, to stay social, to do things, because it's part of the sort of treatment plan. We know that there's different lifestyle things that can help keep people stable. And we certainly emphasize those during our visits. That said, you don't want to cause or put pressure on a caregiver or someone to be sort of a nag or a taskmaster. So finding that balance can be really difficult. Certainly not, you don't want to get, I think a schedule helps or pre-agreed upon activities. So we're going to go golf on Wednesday mornings and that's our plan. And that's the schedule. It could still be hard when it comes to Wednesday morning if that person doesn't want to do it, but you can sort of point to the plan and the agreement ahead of time. But it's really a hard balance. And there's a lot of interpersonal dynamics, people that have been married for 5 years or 55 years. There's a little bit of negotiation in that dance and how much to try and get somebody to do stuff and be less apathetic and to not cause conflict. So sometimes it's also helpful to get other people involved, other family or a caregiver, for even a hired caregiver, if that's a possibility, for, you know, periodic outings to do something that the person likes, whether it's exercise or, going for a walk or whatever it may be. So it's a difficult dance because there's not really any approved medications, so to speak, for quote unquote, just apathy. There's sometimes things that we can try, but there's certainly no FDA approved medications specifically for that symptom. So it tends to be more behavioral strategies and a bit of a negotiation with the caregiver and the other care team around the person. And it looks different for everybody, just depending on their situation. So it can be quite tricky. I do always try to stress that, you know, nobody should feel guilty themselves, a caregiver, for if their person doesn't want to do something or they're struggling to sort of combat the apathy as much as they'd like. Sometimes you just, have to learn to live with a certain amount. But again, that balance is just really hard to find. When it comes to depression, certainly we have much more experience in treatments. You know, there's a lot of available medications. These have been tested in formal clinical trials in dementia and specific diagnoses and been shown to be helpful for these symptoms. So we have a lot of options. And I, as a neurologist, I do a lot of psychiatry within my own clinic, trying to sort of address some of these issues. So the medicines are effective. There's a lot of different options, and they tend to be pretty benign in terms of side effects. Every medication has side effects, but I think we have some good ones, and I've had some success in treating those type of symptoms, the depressive symptoms. Now, there is one caveat. Sometimes when somebody is depressed and you treat their depression with a medication, usually something, you know, like an SSRI that people may be familiar with, instead of, you know, it treats their depression, they become less agitated, they feel better, the sleep is better, all their other symptoms are better, but yet they become apathetic, sort of because they're less, they have less of that agitated, active energy, and so they feel more content. So sometimes you treat somebody's depression and unfortunately induce a little bit of apathy. And in that case, you just have to, you know, do what you can behaviorally and talk about the different options and risk benefit and what's best in any individual person's case. But we certainly see that. So, you know, it's an unfortunate side effect that we sometimes see when we treat depression is more apathy. The person just is, they're content, but they're content not doing much.
I find it so interesting that, and I love how you wrapped it up with the words, a difficult dance. And I love it that you understand from all your work with caregivers, what they're going through, and you've seen what they're going through. And even in your, well, if we want to say your nannying, when you started out, you have lived as a professional caregiver going through life with somebody who has autism, and all the way to becoming a neurologist and working with caregivers on a daily basis. So how do you know as a caregiver how to support someone else when maybe you yourself are going through your own challenges with the dementia and how it's impacting your life?
Sure. So one thing I always stress is, well, for one, you know, a caregiver should never feel guilty for feeling down. They should understand that this is a really difficult situation, and that, you know, they're not alone, and that it's very reasonable to have the feelings that they have. And it's common to see depression in a caregiver. And then secondly, part of the treatment plan for the patient that I'm seeing is to make sure their caregiver is doing well. Because if a caregiver is doing well, feels like they have some time for themselves and is in a good place, that's going to benefit their person. And so if a person wants to neglect themselves because, you know, they're a caregiver and they think that they need to dedicate their time and all their energy to their person, that can actually be, you know, detrimental to that, to the person they're trying to help. So it's extremely important that people are open with how they're feeling and are able to reach out to, you know, I've certainly made the recommendation for caregivers on numerous occasions to maybe seek some counseling or consider, you know, how they're doing a little bit more formally with their own doctor, because this is a disease of a family or more, you know, of a group of people who love each other. And so if that group is suffering together or a care partner is suffering, it affects the whole sort of unit. And you really need to address the situation as much as possible as a whole. And, we're lucky at Banner Alzheimer's Institute to have such a great family community services team who is very aware of this and certainly being proactive in addressing it. But it really is not just for the person who may be suffering, the caregiver who's suffering, but it's for both. It's for the whole, for the patient themselves and the care unit, as I like to, or team, as I like to refer to it as. So there's no shame. It's important for the caregiver themselves, and it's important for the person they love as well, that they're aware and, you know, able to take steps to address problems should they arise, and they often do.
So Dr. Prusin, we've been hearing a lot about the detrimental impact that the pandemic has had on people living with dementia and their care partners, mainly because of the loss of routine and the isolation that they're experiencing. Can you talk to, has this magnified the concern for depression in these individuals as well?
Yeah, so this has been a huge, huge challenge for everybody. With regard to apathy and then some of the symptoms of depression, when you're trying sort of behavioral strategies or trying to get somebody more motivated, you know, if you're in the midst of a lockdown or there's a lot of COVID circulating within the community, there's a perfectly legitimate or, you know, even, you know, responsibility to not go out, or, it, you know, certainly in the past before we had vaccines and some of the other mitigating measures that we've, you know, come to find out about over time with COVID. But certainly that excuse that, oh, COVID, I'm not going to do anything, I'm not going to do this, and that was perfectly legitimate. So trying to combat that, made it during a pandemic, is just almost an impossibility in some ways. You have to try to find something to do in the home or not around other people, which is kind of the opposite of what we're trying to accomplish. And so it just made it incredibly complicated. And then, you know, with regards to the social isolation, it's just been a pandemic upon a pandemic, where people, maybe if they're living in an assisted living, they're not allowed visitors, not even their family. If they get sick and have to go to the hospital, you know, people weren't allowed in. And social isolation, especially in elderly, is just an enormous risk factor itself for depression, dementia or not. And when that's sort of imposed or pushed on because there's respiratory disease floating around out there that may be deadly in this population, you know, how do you get around that? And I think everybody's been struggling to find out. There's been some virtual revolution, but I think there's just something about being in the presence of somebody, tactile, sensory, and all of that, that just really is enriching for a person that has been largely an impossibility or greatly scaled down. So I don't have a great answer. I don't know if anybody does. Hopefully, as time goes on, things can abate a little bit. But it's certainly been a challenge as a clinician and just in general and as a person for everybody, especially in this context. It probably hasn't really affected people, elderly people who may have some cognitive issues more this pandemic, both in terms of their risk of getting sick from COVID and then eliminating a lot of the opportunities and for socialization and to be with other people. So I just can't emphasize how difficult it's been for everybody. And so many people are probably feeling that or maybe shaking their head yes. So I think we all just have to give ourselves a little bit of a break and do the best we can in the situation we find ourselves. So, you know, one thing is, especially now with the vaccinations or, you know, day programs and different activities are really starting to open up. So I encourage people to try and avail themselves, or if they feel they don't feel so comfortable going out. And that's pretty reasonable, to find a loved one, caregiver, friend, or somebody that they can have sort of within their bubble that they emphasize seeing at least periodically as a way to alleviate some of that isolation. But it's really been unprecedented.
With all of this unprecedented impact for people living with dementia and their caregivers, sometimes people find out about strategies that truly can help with dementia. I mean, they might say, hey, you should be exercising more, or maybe watch something funny or find purpose. And an outside person looking in, are there things that they can do to be supportive and help the person living with depression, and whether it's a caregiver or the person living with dementia?
Yeah, one thing I would say on that topic is that people should understand that, you know, if somebody has a pretty significant depression, one thing that tends to happen in terms of agitation can be irritability or being quick to anger. And so it's good for a caregiver to understand that and maybe have that perspective. It may be hard if the person sort of snaps at them in the moment or seems like they're being mean, so to speak. But if the caregiver or loved one can kind of keep that perspective that this is a disease of the brain and that this may be a consequence of Alzheimer's disease and depression, that, you know, okay, they can be a little bit more understanding and sort of make that compartmentalize that sort of incident as opposed to feeling like it was an attack on them or, you know, that the person is specifically angry at them. It's more of a symptom of the disease. So I think keeping that in mind can certainly be one helpful strategy for a caregiver or family member.
I wonder, before we close today, could you give us your final thought when it comes to apathy, depression, and dementia?
Like a lot of things in medicine, especially in the field we're in, is that you have to think about a balance and, you know, how do you, for any person's and their loved one's situation, you know, what is best in their case? Certainly, we don't want people to be agitated and depressed and very down. And I think we want to treat those symptoms, but, you know, let's say, for example, we induce an apathy, then, you know, how do we respond to that? What's the best sort of way to approach that? And I like the dance analogy in that, you know, we have to understand what's the best way to achieve the highest quality of life for the longest period of time for a person, and understand that there's going to be bumps along the road, a little bit of trial and error, trying different strategies in terms of medications, behavioral strategies, and then ultimately finding the best balance among, you know, do we use medications? Do we not? Are they too inactive? Do they feel too agitated? And really to say that this process takes time. It's the song is long that we're dancing to, and eventually, usually a good equilibrium is found. And to, you know, give it time, take it easy on yourself, and, you know, work with your person and your doctor and their treatment team to get it figured out. And it's going to be an evolving process.
Today, our conversation has been with Dr. Jeremy Prusin, who's a neurologist at Banner Alzheimer's Institute. We so appreciate you taking the time to help us untangle apathy, depression, and dementia. And to our listeners, if some of these signs and symptoms resonated with you, or if thoughts are becoming overwhelming, please reach out for help. You are not alone. There is a National Suicide Prevention Hotline that can be reached at 800-273-8255. And this is a nationwide network of over 160 crisis centers that provide 24/7 service. It's available to anyone in suicidal crisis or emotional distress.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Heather. We know that this is a heavy topic, and we do hope that people will reach out. And I think that just by listening today, we've gotten support and help. So thank you so much, Dr. Prusin, for joining us.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you for having me to talk about this important topic. And yeah, I'll just close with, you know, don't be afraid to reach out to your doctor, to your friends, if you're a caregiver or if you're a patient, there's no shame. And we really need to understand that. And don't be afraid to bring up how you're feeling to a loved one or your doctor.
Thank you again, Dr. Prusin. We truly appreciate it. And thank you, Heather, for another great conversation. And of course, we thank our listeners for joining us. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Dementia Untangled and share this podcast. I'm looking forward to our next conversation on Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Dementia Untangled. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dementia Untangled is hosted by Heather Mulder and Janice Greeno, produced and edited by Amber Ayers, and is brought to you by Banner Alzheimer's Institute and Banner Sun Health Research Institute. We are supported by generous donations to the Banner Alzheimer's Foundation.
Please visit our website at banneralz.org and follow us on Facebook to learn about upcoming events. If you have questions or comments, please email us at dementiauntangled@bannerhealth.com.